Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dan Gruneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan is an advisor and executive coach for purpose-driven leaders who need help solving their organization's toughest obstacles. With experience in urban, rural, remote, and First Nations communities, Jonathan's expertise is in social purpose business strategy, governance, branding, change, and communication. Tune in to discover, first, if they plan the battle, they won't battle the plan. Bringing people into the decision-making process early creates alignment and reduces resistance when it's time to execute. Second, generational differences in the workforce. Younger professionals approach work as an extension of their identity, bringing emotional awareness and new expectations, forcing leaders to adapt their leadership style to be more engaging and participatory. And finally, the gold dust is at the start. The best outcomes come from investing time up front, whether in strategy, onboarding, or stakeholder engagement, rather than trying to fix things after they go wrong. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dan Gruneveld, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group, and today I'm joined by Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan's a strategic advisor with Clearly Then. He's had a cool story. He shares with me a mid-Pacific accent, I'm told, so we'll get into that. And it's just going to be fun getting into this conversation today. So welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be here, mate.
Yeah, absolutely. So we should start with mid-Pacific accent, shouldn't we?
We probably should.
Yeah.
Yes, given that we're both in North America, but originally from Australia.
Yeah, that's it. So where did you say it originated from? It was a good friend or?
An old friend of mine described my accent as mid-Pacific, which I just thought was very clever because, you know, there's the old sort of mid-Atlantic kind of, you know, English slash American kind of nowhere accent. And that's sort of what it feels like after you've been in North America as an Australian for, in my case, 30 years. Yeah. You know, your accent is still there. It's how you grow up and it's how you talk, but it's definitely lost its edge.
Yeah, but I like how you're holding on to it. I'm certainly emulating that and hope to be at the same place at my 30-year mark too.
Nice, nice. That's what
Jonathan, for the benefit of our listeners, other than coming from Australia, you know, what is it about your story that's brought you to be doing this really cool work with leaders and teams now?
Yeah, thanks. So I've had a really varied and unstructured career, which has led me to this point. I have an undergrad in English lit, and when I graduated, all I wanted to do was write novels and poetry, you know, where the big bucks are, right? So I did that, and I was really fortunate. I had a lovely literary career. I wrote 7 books. I traveled the country and festivals and awards, and it was great. But it also, in practical terms, really didn't pay the bills. And so along the way, I developed a career in corporate communications, which led into general management. Found myself on the senior team of a huge hospital here in Canada. I'm in Ontario, Canada. Mm-hmm. And we built a new hospital. I made it through 2 CEOs, 3 CEOs, I guess. It was like just a free MBA, the whole thing. It was incredible. Really, really complex environment. Thousands of employees, open 24/7, 4 different unions, really, really complex environment. And so sitting on the senior team of that organization, I just, you know, I gained a lot. I learned a lot. At the end, I was sort of exhausted, had a little kid. My eldest is autistic. And so I just needed to reconstitute my life and I needed to gain back some control and also refocus it on some things that really matter to me, some purpose-driven work. So I founded a management consulting company called Laridae and for the next 10 years, grew it, scaled it. And 3 years ago, I sold it. Mm-hmm. We became a B Corp and did some amazing work. We worked with nonprofits right across the country.
Yep.
And these days, I'm a trusted advisor. I work one-on-one with executives and teams to help them solve really tough things and reset themselves and go after the things that matter to them most.
That's neat. I didn't realize you started out as a poet. My father-in-law is a poet. He was at UT Austin in Texas.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I've always had a fond, a soft spot for poets, and it's nice. It's great to see that creativity play out. And it's interesting how you moved into communications and then into general management. There's a lot to be said right now, and I think for the last 10 or 15 years, around people bringing a little bit more connectivity to emotions and creativity in the workplace, because, as you said, extremely complex, lots of people, lots of things happening.
Yeah.
So often that's a really good channel to kind of tune into, get the frequency right from.
Love that. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, you bet. So tell me more about the free MBA, because that's a new term that I haven't heard before, but I think I get it.
Because we were under a huge capital project, like building a new hospital.
Yeah.
These are just, a million square feet kind of building, just these enormous things that are so expensive. I was the chief communications officer. So I was the head of government relations and the brand, comms, you name it. Spend a ton of time with the board of directors, lots of time in the media, lots of focus locally on the build and where are we going to be on budget and on time and trying to catch us up on every little thing,
Yeah.
So it was it was just an awful lot. And I guess as I started to grow into the role and do better, so many moving parts in hospitals, I just got given things to babysit. So, the person that does patient relations isn't here. Can you do that for 6 months? And, I got the privacy file for a while. And just being a manager on call and just having to look after the hospital at night, being the person to, you get a call from the ICU nurse and you're like, what should I do? She knows all you wanted to do is say, spend the money. That's really the answer. But, my answer was, what would you do if it was during the day? And she'd say, well, I'd do this. And I'd say, probably do that then. But, you sort of just are in proximity to a lot of really complex decision-making and a lot of moving parts. And I just really gained a ton from that. I don't even think I knew what I was learning until after I left. And I realized I knew how to do lots of things as I was becoming a management consultant because I had been engaged and involved in really complex multi-stakeholder processes across the health system, not just the hospital.
That's fascinating. Then I can see why you relate it to an MBA now. Do you think that just that origin point of coming from communications, where you are working across, like you said, government relations and P&L and budget and patients and everything else, do you think that's what positioned you as a leader to be called upon by so many team members? Was it just that you already had that kind of interface and span of access to the organization, or was it something else?
I certainly developed an outside ability for indirect influence. Mm. I cultivated a lot of social capital in that role, and I was able to horse trade favors and get people to agree to things that maybe they didn't want to do all of it. And so I did get really good at that. And also, I'm a quick decision maker and fairly good at holding a room. And all of those skills that naturally came through were good.
Yeah.
And I've continued to sort of, grow and build on those over the years in other work. I sit on a lot of boards. I'm a chartered director, and I sit on 3 corporate boards and a nonprofit board, and I've chaired lots of boards. And so all of those skills also kind of wrap into the work I do.
That's neat. You've touched on some superpowers there too. So, that social capital, everything that I've read around like organizational network analysis and finding the people who others go to in an organization, which isn't always obvious on an org chart, and is particularly critical in a project environment where you've got non-standard, non-routine operations.
Yeah,
that's a key role to play for any team member.
Yeah, you probably as you go into organizations, as a consultant, I would always be looking for those people because where you'd find sometimes lots of access to what's really going on really quickly, and you could turbocharge your analysis.
It's a great place both for the analysis but also for that change agency.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you're rolling out something and you find out the people with the social capital, if you can bring them on so they'll spend it on your behalf. Sure, it's great.
That's cool. And the connectedness. The decision making is another one that really stands out. And I think I saw one of your posts here the other day about, you know, sometimes a business can outgrow its board. It's also true of its leadership team or, you know, departmental leader.
Yeah.
But decision-making has become, I almost feel harder at times because of just the sheer volume of information that's available and your access to lots of different people digitally. How did you see decision-making change from your time, like in that big hospital environment into, you know, management consulting and now in the consulting work that you're doing directly with leaderships and teams and boards?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that decision-making sits alongside accountability, really, mm-hmm. really close by it. And people that are good decision-makers are also people that usually have a fairly intimate relationship with accountability.
Yes.
They hold it close to them. Especially, you know, so if you care a lot, you want to get stuff done. And if you want to get stuff done well, you need to bring people along with you, which means having deep engagement strategies and make sure, you know, the old line about if they plan the battle, they won't battle the plan. And allowing people to kind of fold into the process long before they're ready, before you need them, and allow them to participate, then they're going to feel engagement and they're going to feel, you know, a sense of involvement. Then when it comes time to pull the trigger, well, they've already been there and they've already heard about us. They're more likely to come along with you and they're more likely to be a champion for you. So, you know, communications and stakeholder engagement work is really about, these are some of the core frameworks that you use in that work. And I noticed that, you know, when you transpose these across to other project-based work or board work or just operations work, it turns out not a lot of people think like this.
Yeah.
And so you find out, like, you know, I don't know, you work with an accounting team and you're like, you know, we should include so-and-so. And they're like, why? They can't do anything about it. And you're mm-hmm. like, but they will care later and we should involve them now. And then they won't dig their heels in and be really stubborn.
Yeah.
But the transactional nature of some, and I don't mean to pick on accounting. Accountants are great, but like-
They get a hard rap.
They do get a hard rap, actually. It's not fair. I shouldn't have said that. But they- I think that there's, let's say, a better way of coming out. There's some personality types that just have a more transactional relationships at work, and they tend to not think broader, and they tend to not think, you know, I'm not talking four-dimensional chess. I'm just talking three moves down the board. You know, like let's think a little ahead, and we're probably going to need them, you know, in 3 months' time. And so if it's new to them and they haven't fed in, our project will be better if we include them now and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's very real. And I've seen a lot of my career, I've spent around building big oil and gas facilities. And I've seen some of the best examples of teams there is when they bring the operating teams onto the design and the construction phase. Because then when they're doing the handoff to the operations team, they've already factored in some of those things that only an operator is really going to see.
Yeah.
And so they're not turning up and taking control of this plan and saying, well, why'd you put this here? And why haven't you made this more accessible for my maintenance crews? And it just creates a lot more efficacy and efficiency for what you're trying to achieve across the wider team.
That'd be fascinating. I can't imagine what was that like? What was building those things like?
It was cool. I was rarely on site. I'd go on walk sites at times, but I got to bring on like the head of engineering, the head of construction, the safety manager, the quality manager, the technical writing and information management teams. And you just get to see all of those interfaces playing out. And often you're building those facilities from four different countries. So you're not all on the one site. So it's fascinating just seeing the way that the teamwork plays across, you know, silos in an organization or project packages.
Totally. Wow. Yeah. That's awesome. It's cool.
That's super cool. That's a big part of why I think I got so fascinated on teamwork.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you talked about stakeholder engagement there, and I love that quote you mentioned there, Jonathan, which is if they plan the battle, they won't battle the plan.
Yeah, that's an oldie but a goodie.
I
love it. Yeah. I think about that. I've done more strategic plans than I care to admit, hundreds. And I think about that a lot when I'm designing a process for an organization. I really am thinking about it from a participatory kind of point of view. Like if we want this thing to be meaningful, And if we want folks to engage, then who are they all? And might they engage? Will they engage? Will they know? What are they going to say when I go into a focus group with them? And if you don't know, that's just, it's not bad. It's just interesting information.
Yeah.
And if you think a bunch of assumptions about them, what are they? And I'll test those assumptions. And I think that that work is really interesting because it helps make a plan that's not, you know, inward and then out, but outward and then in. And,
yes.
And it's such a richer document. It's far more likely to live, get implemented. I mean, that's where the rub on these things, they all, you know, knock on strategic plans, they sit on a shelf and,
yeah,
you know, and then the consultant gets a bad rap and, you know, I'll just defend consultants everywhere. It's not a strategic consultant's job to implement your strategy. It's your strategy.
Correct.
They just helped you get it there. Like if it sits on a shelf, that's your fault.
Yeah.
So back to accountability and decision making, really.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Yeah.
It makes me think about that participatory approach. There's a big kind of topic that I've been circling in the last 3 or 4 months, which is mattering. Because everyone talks about belonging, right? To belong is to be, you know, accepted, to feel welcomed. Yeah. But to matter is to feel like your work is important and significant to others on the team.
Yeah.
And I think that that accountability piece ties heavily into mattering, because if I know that I was involved in the plan working with you, Jonathan, and my role is to have my team do these pieces so that the next team can do their pieces,
yeah,
then we all matter to each other. We appreciate and respect and recognize each other more, and it just creates that. Better bonds in the team.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, those kinds of that kind of thinking tucks into psychologically safe work environments too. And I think that when people feel seen at work, when they feel like they can put themselves out there and say the hard thing, or the I'm unsure, I don't know, or I'm sorry, and not fear reprisal or retribution or ridicule, then you're in a healthy and safe work environment. And I think that if that person was in front of us and we'd say, what does it feel like around here? They'd say something like, my work matters. I feel seen and people care about the things that I do. I'm not just a cog in a wheel. People appreciate my work. And that, you know, I think we would want that for anyone doing any kind of job, really, on some basic human level.
Yeah, I think so. And it actually takes us back to the conversation you and I were having pre-show, which is just the emergence of the new generation into the workplace.
Yeah.
Because I think that's going to be very critical. It already is for a lot of that generation. So what are you seeing as you're seeing these kind of more expressive, you know, aware individuals entering early career into these organizations?
I mean, you know, I do executive advisory work, but I also go down inside organizations as well. So, you know, I'm on retainer with some companies and they send me down and I'm, you know, kind of coaching folks that are in their late 20s, early 30s. They have a totally different approach to work. I mean, A, they've done therapy for sure.
Yeah.
And it you can just feel it.
Yeah.
Like, they come into your space and they're ready to tell you what meds they're on and you know what they're working through, their traumas, and they want to talk about business as well, for sure.
Yeah.
But they can do both and it's easy for them. And you know, then the next day I'm coaching the CEO and you know, who's a Gen Xer like me, and they, you know, like I and they grew up under completely different rules.
Mm.
And they're still feeling pretty rattled. And some of it is just, you know, when they're not doing well, they sound like their old boss. Like I'll often say to them, whose voice is that you're using right now? Like, where did you learn that? And they'll be like, you know, I grew up under there. And I'm like, but it's not working anymore.
Yeah.
Like it was good advice in 1995, but it's not good advice anymore.
Yeah.
Like it's not landing. They don't want that. It's, you know, they're not going to do it just because they're happy to have a job and they get paycheck every 2 weeks. Like that's not enough. And yet these young people are looking at their careers as an extension of themselves. It's a part of their identity. And this is giving them a sense of purpose. And so if you're an employer and you don't see them for who they are and what they care about and how what they do as work aligns with your work, then you won't keep them.
Yeah.
And so you know, even, I mean, yes, like the employment cycle goes up and down and we need people. No, we don't need people. Like, for sure, I get that. But this will not change.
No.
Like, it's not going to change. They're not going to become a whole new generation of people. These are folks that are coming into the workforce with a whole different set of values. That, I mean, their relationship with capitalism is just genuinely suspicious. And it's not just because they're young. They've got the tools, the intellectual heft and structures to think about the harm that is happening. And they're happy to talk about it. And yet, you know, they need a job. They're not foolish. They want to work. But they also are pretty aware of what's going on.
Yes.
And so, you know, you can't fake it as an employer. You can't, you know, the greenwashing-y stuff, like, it ain't just going to fly very far. Like, they see through it all.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. You've hit on so many good points there, Jonathan. I think I just hit a half a page of notes in the last minute and a half.
Oh, sorry, I was talking fast too.
No, I love it. I love it. Luckily, I took the notes. So the one that I thought was very interesting when you said totally different, they've been to therapy. That's really interesting because I recently started doing some therapy for myself in my 40s because of a strained relationship with my 13-year-old son. And I started learning these frameworks and I was like, oh my gosh, why didn't I know this before?
Oh, it's
mind-blowing. Like, we should be teaching some of that stuff in school. So I appreciate the fact that you said, hey, they're bringing these tools and openness of communicating around emotions to the workplace. That is fascinating.
They are. I mean, congrats on doing some work on yourself. Like, it feels good, right?
And yeah, it does.
Me too. I came to the party way too late, for sure. But all the therapy I've done, and I'm married to a therapist, is been very enriching. It's given me a whole different set of tools. You know, just the idea of like doing mindfulness work and having some metacognition, it makes you show up to a meeting differently.
Yeah.
Like, you come into, you know, I'll come into a board meeting and I'm like, okay, Jonathan, wait, stop. How am I? Where am I? How am I doing? Am I bringing the wrong vibe into this meeting? Who is in the meeting with me?
Yeah.
What is going on around there? And just sort of slowing myself down helps to just, I don't know, be a better decision maker, be a better colleague, be, you know, all of these things. And I'm far less likely to you know, come in too hot or, you know, get distracted by the wrong thing. Cause I've gained some skills and some tools to be able to self-diagnose, to check in, to just be more aware. Ah, I mean, I'm with you. Why wasn't I doing this in my 20s?
I know. There's so many examples of situations that I blew a lot of, going back to your earlier word, social capital around, you know, in teams and with customers and, it's interesting that the big part of my learning through, you know, the therapy I've done is just this whole thing about, you know, feelings being there and stop racing into like rationalize and fix, like just acknowledge someone's feelings, just see them and say, hey, I understand why that's frustrating for you, or I understand why you're afraid of that. And just have that moment to acknowledge it. And it's amazing how much that just diffuses everything in any tense moment in a business or a team.
It's wild. I mean, I'll share with you a secret. My clients hate it when I do this, but I coach a lot of women. And so typically they have more access to naming, attaching the feeling to the word that describes the feeling. They're better at doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, societally, men in general, maybe not as good. So I'll make men do that. I'm working with them and it drives them crazy. And I'll say, so what's that bringing up for you? What are you feeling? And they'll say, I don't know. I want that. Firstly, they don't answer. They deflect. They start, they go back and they talk about it. I'm like, okay, so you're not giving me a feeling word here. So let's just wind this back. Give me a feeling. And they'll be like, I just need to get it done. I'm like, no, it's not a feeling. Let's get a feeling. And sometimes I swear to God, I'll like give them a pick list. Okay, so I'm going to name some feelings until you hear the word that describe happy, sad, angry, frustrated, annoyed. Annoyed, that's it. I'm annoyed. Terrific. And then you watch what happens is they go, huh, I'm annoyed.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, they've just labeled the thing.
Just floats up.
And then just like you say, it can begin to dissipate.
Yeah.
Because we have a place for that word and that feeling that attaches to it. God, we suck at this stuff. So yeah, there you go.
It's cool. It's really cool with the young generation. And because they all carry a lot more anxiety than I think we did growing up, it helps them deal with that anxiety in the moment too. Outside of work, my family were all skiing a couple of weeks ago, and my youngest hit this part of the mountain that was a bit scary, a few bumps late in the day.
Yeah.
And she was very anxious and afraid. And my wife's like, hey, just let your feeling be. I understand you're anxious and afraid. What does that sound like? So she just starts, you know, shouting, growling, screaming, whatever it is. And she just keeps skiing down the mountain. But at least we helped her kind of just like accept it and process that anxiety. And we didn't let it turn into a big episode or tantrum.
I mean, that's just great parenting.
Yeah.
It is so true that the anxiety they're carrying, I mean, it was, of course, exacerbated by the pandemic, but it is real. So I have two kids, 20 and 18. And my insight into the anxious generation, to talk about the book that just came out last year, is it feels pretty close to me right now. You know, that's really where they're mm-hmm. at. And it's true of all their friends and how terminally online they all are, but how just complex their world is. And I do definitely think it is different. It's just not the same.
Yeah, it really is. And on the flip side, like those could be, particularly to those Gen X managers, I like the way you said, they start talking like their boss, their old boss, when they're stressed.
Yeah.
Because I can see that. I've been there.
Yeah.
But for those folks who are kind of listening in and thinking about, oh, gee, I'm really struggling with this newer group of employees, there's a lot of upside. There's a lot of positivity that comes from bringing their way of seeing the world into your workplace and into your team. What do you tend to see in the teams that you're working with, executives you're coaching, advising, that they're able to sort of harness and make more of with this, intergenerational team?
Yeah, I think that the execs that are able to learn how to not do to or for, but do with their younger workers, who are good at building agreements, who think about going slow to go fast. These are the sorts of like approaches to working with those folks. They are loyal. They are such hard workers.
Yeah.
They're just as good as any other generation. It ain't nothing. Like, it's garbage, all that stuff.
Yeah.
The anxiety stuff and the environment has changed, and that's impacting how they're showing up, but they've also got new and different skills than we have. So I just think about it as helping the leaders that I work with to just get more patient, get more curious, learn mm-hmm. how to ask more questions, and build agreements and work with people. Like, you don't need to dump work on people. You don't need to swoop in at the last minute and save the day. Like, just sit down next to people and do work with people and assume competence and be trusting. And so I work with execs to try to rewire the brain that it was wired to be successful under a different regime.
Yes.
And they waited a long time. Gen X waited a long time for the boomers hung on a long time in the corner office. So they waited a long time. So they're kind of past due when they finally get there, kind of like the King Charles thing. And so now they're there, and wait a second, all the rules have changed.
Yeah.
And all these people want all these different stuff. And I can't just like, I finally at the top of the sandcastle and I can't do all the things that were done to me.
Yeah.
And that's really, some of it feels a bit like lunch bag letdown, and they just like don't know what to do. They don't have the right skills. So that's, I spend a lot of time with them, and it's scripting a lot of the time. Like, they'll come in and they're like, I'm just like a cognitive thing. And so I'm like, okay, let's have the conversation together. I'll be the person. And then we do it backwards and forwards. And I'm like, let's do that again. It's kind of like we're just like in a play and we're doing lines.
Yeah.
And that's quite helpful. I find that's very helpful, because then they leave having actually had the conversation and they're far more equipped to go and do it. And even just the act of working with somebody like me that kind of like works from a position of curiosity and lots of questions. People that work with me over the long time, they end up saying, oh, I was channeling you, or I'm starting to sound like you. And like, to me, it's like funny and delightful that they would think those things, but also it feels like then it's working. Because they're more effective with the folks that they have to manage.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah. I wonder, when they're channeling you, have they got the Mid-Pacific accent too?
I don't know. know whether they've gone that far.
Maybe just a few mannerisms.
Maybe. Who knows? That's funny.
But the role playing in scripts is really powerful, because we just ran a research project out of our HR consulting business Leader the other day. We did a DEIB reset survey, because DEIB is coming under fire, particularly with the new administration here. It's terrible.
Wow.
And people just want to blame it on for everything.
Yeah.
We went out and did a survey with a range of leaders, and what was fascinating was a lot of those leaders responded that they understand and believe in what it is and how it should play out, but they don't have the tool set, the skill set, to be able to appropriately interact with their teams and community participants to really do the execution work. So there's still like an awkwardness, just like there is with, you know, between generations in the workforce. So sometimes the only way to beat that is role-playing and scenarios. And, you know, you got to make it a bit of play and create that safe environment so that people can actually develop the aptitude.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. What? How did it go? How did your training go?
It's still in process. We've been doing training in that DEIB space for years, but we're bringing a different approach now, which is less of the awareness and more of like the practical, let's have tough conversations. Let's encounter a scenario together. So that's where we're shifting our content.
Nice. That's really good. I've been doing a lot of work with Indigenous people here in Canada, mm-hmm. and it's really shifting my brain space about how I'm doing my work. I talk about decision making and how meetings are held and how you hold space. And
yeah,
it's funny. So I'm in Williams Treaty territory, and one of the ways that when they come together, when Indigenous people come together, they typically will tell their ancestral story, like where they're from and
yes.
And who their people are. And that's their way of kind of just connecting. And it takes what Western white people would think, like it takes a long time, but that's how they're building trust. So then actually they can do their work quite quickly at the end. And we would have raced to begin, and then we would have floundered because we would have dug in our heels because the trust wasn't there.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, I'm learning a lot of skills, like, and also just like how they introduce themselves is quite amazing. Like you and I wouldn't get on a call and like say, like I'd be like, oh, hi Dane. And it's like, hi Jonathan. Well, my grandparents, they came to Canada through Guernsey, and on my mother's side, they went to, they like convict stock on my mother's side, and also Scottish. Like, and then you do your version of that. Like, we would never talk like that. But that is exactly, like, if I was sort of like translating it, that's exactly how they kind of come together. If you think about it, how beautiful and personal and intimate and relational that work can be. So I'm just like, I mean, I've been doing this work for quite a long time, but like I'm still, not a day goes by I don't learn new stuff.
It's cool, isn't it?
It's great.
That's the best part.
It's really
important. I like that storytelling kind of, there's a geographic sort of locational grounding that comes with that
to the land
absolutely.
For them, which is everything.
And that's important, because when you think about so much of what we do today, particularly in the digital age, we become very detached from our communities, from the land that we're on, from the impact we're having on the outside environment too. So I find that fascinating.
Me too.
Super cool. You also touched on over here when you're working with leaders and you're kind of coaching them to do with rather than to do to or for. That reminds me, one of my good friends, Kurt Landon, he does a lot of coaching with executives, and he's got this acronym, QFYAY. It's questions for you about you. And it's just a really powerful kind of lens.
Nice.
To be thinking like, what questions have I got about my own leadership style as it relates to managing this team or managing this new generation of workforce or handling my board? When you're working with leaders, how do you see the more sort of proactive, you know, growth mindset leaders showing up with curiosity as opposed to those folks that are more traditionally following in the steps of, you know, their boomer predecessors?
Yeah, I think folks that are good at, like when we grew up, there was this sort of alternative way of doing it, which was servant leadership, you know? And in fact, I don't think that was right either. And the way I kind of think about it is my metaphor is let's move from being on the other side of the table from one another to metaphorically sitting on the same side of the table and putting the problem in front of us.
Mm.
And so if I'm sitting on the other side of the table with you and the problem is in front of us, you know, I'm going to push the problem towards you. You're going to push back towards me. I'm going to push down the thing. Maybe we both get up and walk away. But like, if there's nothing but us on one side of the table and the problem is in front of us, then we're all looking at it from the same vantage point. And so how do we go about inviting folks to sit next to us, to sit alongside us?
Yeah.
And I like that metaphor because it's sort of, it's invitational, it's grounding, it's just not confrontation. Like when we're standing shoulder to shoulder, that metaphorically means we're on the same side and we're working towards the problem and fixing the problem or the opportunity or the growth or whatever the thing is, right? But that's, so I think about that a lot. And the word with matters a lot. I know I already said it, but it matters a lot to me because I think whenever we do work with people, together, as opposed to two or four, it really allows for good agreements to get built, for people to know why they matter, for people to know how we can contribute and how we can feel seen and valued. Those things can kind of come together.
Yeah, I think that's a super powerful analogy. Almost remove the chairs, just put the subject on the table and you can walk around it. You can ponder.
Yeah.
It's cool. Yeah. It's very cool.
That's cool.
As you think sort of forwards into leaders that work with their teams, have you got a viewpoint? I heard you mention agreements. Maybe this is where the tie-in is there. Have you got a viewpoint on how and where leaders choose to work with their teams?
It's too late when it's already gone wrong. Like to me, the gold dust is at the start. Like that's where to go. It's go slow at the start. I have a really good friend of mine. She's a Canadian politician, former Canadian politician. And a line that she always walks around and says, she's in lots of rooms and does lots of work in front of lots of people. She often asks, who's not in this room?
Mm.
Like who has no access? Who wasn't invited? How did we draw a circle around ourselves here, right? Like is really what she's saying.
Yeah.
And I've always appreciated that. It's confronting in a gentle way. And so, you know, I think leaders that think about how we came here, have a sense of positionality, are attuned to how everybody else around them is showing up. And what's going on for them. I don't mean you have to know everything. Don't bring all your messy self to work. Like I'm not actually all about bringing your vulnerable self to work. Like I think that's what friends and family and therapists and all kinds of stuff. Like it's a lot to put on an employer to also be your mom and your therapist and all the other stuff. Like I don't think that's fair.
Yep.
But I do think that you should be able to be safe enough to say I'm not doing great today. You don't have to get into it, but if you don't want. Or you don't have to listen to it if you don't have the skills or the time, but the ability to be able to say, I see you and I hear you and you're not doing great. And so I'll just take that into account as we do our business today.
Yeah.
I think that makes for safety.
Yeah, it does.
And I think that that's about how far it has to extend in the world of work. It can be more than that. If we both choose, it can be more than that, then fair. But like, I think at a place to begin, it should be safe enough that we can admit where we're at. And
absolutely.
So leaders that can do those kinds of things, I think, are really succeeding in this environment. And they're taking teams with them. You know, they move and their people move with them.
Yeah.
Because they really don't want to lose that. Because it's sadly just a bit too rare.
Yeah. I'm going to replay that. I love that quote, the gold dust is at the start. Because there is something, particularly, you know, with your creative origins as well, there's something nice and very inclusive and accessible about starting with a blank piece of paper or a canvas rather than having to come in and fix something once you've already done 80% of the body.
Oh, yeah. Like if we could just spend my moment here. I think the starts of things are, we skip over it so quickly. For some reason, we all want to get into it. Like the start of everything is great. Nothing's gone wrong yet. It's about we build agreements on how we're going to do our work together and how we're going to show up together, what the principles are, what the foundational stuff is. Like the more work we do at the start, the better the thing will be as we go and do it, because we'll already have, before anything, it's a bit like a prenup or something. You know, it's like yeah. If the bad things happen, how are we going to treat one another? How are we going to be? And so we've already agreed. So now we get to say, when the bad thing happens, we can say, oh, remember when we talked about this back at the start? You got a placeholder back there earlier in the timeline, and you can pull it back. And, you know, like, origin stories themselves are valuable to kind of like manufacture and create. Like, organizations that do great onboarding really treat it like a serious, serious thing. And I think it lasts like a year of attachment. Like, I really think about it like attachment theory, like for infants. Yeah. It's you can tell a new person in an organization that they've, you know, probably been stressed trying to get a job. They finally get the job, and then they're like, have I made the right choice? Am I safe? Are they as nice as they seemed in the interview? Like, the first 3 months, they're just in shock.
Yes.
And then you've got a period of time where they're trying to fake it and make sure nobody figures out they don't really know what they're doing. And at the year mark, they're like, okay, I got this. I work here. I've seen a full cycle. I'm good. Bring it on. Right. And so, but like, you know,
the energy drain is intense.
Oh, and in our minds, you know, we're just like, we've got this empty chair we want to fill. And suddenly there's a new person here. Ah, you know, we're so sweet for the first week. And here's the swipe card, and there's where the washrooms is. Good luck. And then boom, you dump a bunch of work on them and you say sink or swim. We'll see whether we made a good choice. Like, that's just abysmal. So, but it happens all the time, and it comes from a place of like less than that we're all dealing with because we don't have enough resources or capacity. And so, you know, we just chuck it on. But I mean, great organizations really care about onboarding and orientation because they know this person's starting to attach. And like, a little tip I have sometimes is like, listen for, at about the 4 to 6 month mark, people's language moves from at this company to we and us.
Yeah.
And that's a lovely little tell that can happen.
Yeah, it is. It really is. I think that it goes beyond onboarding too, probably going back to your work agreements, the way you described it. When you're very intentional about how you're going to run the business, it makes it easy for everything, like easy to hire into the future of your talent, easier to performance manage people that aren't a fit with the way you've agreed to work, easy to explain to your customer what your process is or your vendor what your process is.
Yes.
And otherwise you end up with this Frankenstein team or organization with all of these processes that were built by different leaders, some of which were bought from other organizations which bear no resemblance to our own. And that's many years of work to kind of reprogram.
So true. So true.
It makes me want to run out and do a startup.
That is, and like I almost said that earlier, like you I mean, that's, people are addicted to startups because there's nothing wrong. It's great. It's just possibility. It's just endless possibility. It's just pure optimism. And you can see why people get addicted to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, there's been so many cool themes that we've touched on here. Probably the one that we didn't hit was like, how does self-expression show up in the workplace as you've perceived it with the new generation coming through?
Oh, I think self-expression is changing right now.
Yeah.
I think it's changing. And I think we're probably in a backlash point here for sure around DEI and around other things that really matter to many young people. But it turns out, so, you know, for a good long while, that meant that people wanted to bring their whole selves to work. They wanted to be out. They wanted to be culturally relevant and safe and all these sorts of things. And now we're seeing a huge backlash against that. And conservative people are saying, and I want all my things here too. And that feels like an assault and affront. And so we're having a moment right now. And where it was not cool to talk about politics at work for a very long time. I was just on a call earlier today with a very, very senior philanthropic leader in the US. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, donors are asking me about my political leanings in meetings.
Wow.
Like, not about my institution, well, in her case, a company,
just personally,
but about my personal stuff.
Yeah.
She said, like, the boldness around that is really confronting. And, like, she wanted to, like, workshop, like, how do I How do I deal with that?
I can imagine.
I just flip the coach button. I don't know. How do you deal with that?
It feels like a safe pathway.
I was like, oh my God, that's a really hard one. And it's difficult because, you know, you can't be somebody that you're not, and yet you don't want to see, in her case, like $1 million donor walk out the door. But maybe you do. If their money is not really attached to your values, maybe that's exactly the right thing to do. So these things are really complex. And I think it's, you know, it's up there at the top, and it's also right at the front door. The most sort of entry level junior folks show up in early in their careers, and they want to express themselves, and they want to be who they are in an authentic way. And as management, we have to somehow know how to incorporate that into the conversation. And sometimes it does need bending and adjusting, and we have to smooth off the edges.
Yeah.
And other times it's not appropriate for that, and there's no reason why they couldn't do that. So, you know.
Yeah, it is fascinating. It reminds me when we acquired the HR consulting business just over a year ago, we had a number of their team come on to like a town hall to talk about the acquisition and what our group of companies does. Okay. And the largest business in our group of companies is an oil and gas staffing firm. It's broadening out into the wider energy, you know, more power and renewables now, but historically oil refineries and chemicals plants. And naturally, this very diligent and successful professional on the consulting side of the business said, well, what are the values of the parent company? And what's the investment thesis if you guys are hanging on to this asset when we're all about, you know, better communities and saving the world? And it was just like, wow, that's a question I would have never asked my CEO.
No.
I was at that stage.
No, you wouldn't.
I appreciated it.
Right.
I appreciated it.
Right. You said, let me tell you the story of Robin Hood. No.
I couldn't flip the coach button. That was the problem.
What do you think we should do? I mean, but like, you know, on some level you're hearing that and you're like, oh my God, can you imagine having the guts to do that? And yet, God bless them. Thank you. Bring it. Because they're the questions that the world is going to be asking of us. And so if not inside, we're not ready for the outside, which is even harder.
So 100%.
It's a gift. It's a gift, and you have to embrace it, and then how, you know, say the hard part out loud around the senior team.
Yeah, it really is.
Wow, that's a great one.
It was super good. I love being put to the test more often. I've always been more of a shoot from the hip guy too, so I think working with the younger generation is exciting for that.
Yeah, it does. Great,
but no, it's neat. But it's been a great conversation, Jonathan. Covered tons of ground. So many good sound bites. I still love. If they plan the battle, they don't battle the plan. That one's cool. Very important for a lot of leaders and teams right now. Loved where we went to with sort of the therapy, the emotional awareness, and also like some of the points that you touched on there around engaging stakeholder engagement in the communications plans, working with Indigenous communities, just seeing how different people show up and kind of get grounded. There are so many great takeaways for teams that are going through growth and challenge, and it's a lot of valuable stuff for the future of teamwork.
Thank you, Dane. Thank you for having me on. I really enjoyed this conversation too.
Yeah, you bet. Well, if any of our listeners want to find you, maybe they need a strategic advisor to help with their own organizations or boards, how do they best find you, Jonathan?
Yeah, I'm at clearlythen.com. I'm super active on LinkedIn. I'm a real person. If you DM me, I will DM you back. Mostly I book trial calls with people that are curious about my work. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to staying connected, practicing our mid-Pacific accents, and finding some ways to work together in the future.
I would love that. That sounds really cool.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time,